not enough time is spent on strategy. Yeah. Are you working on the right things? Yeah. And actually, most people are probably not working on the right things.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. You're listening to Scaling DevTools. I'm joined today by Sean Wang, also known as Swix on the internet, for his return appearance on Scaling DevTools. And I think in that first episode, I gave a very gushing fan appreciation. I'm definitely a fanboy of Swix, have been for a long time. Swix does the Laden Space podcast, which is probably the biggest podcast on like AI engineering right now, runs the AI engineering conference. Well, so we've got Summit and you've got the AI Engineering World Fair, two huge conferences in San Francisco. Been to both of them, they're amazing. And in the past was DevRel at companies like Netlify, Git, AWS, and
Temporal and Airbyte.
And was like huge in building public. You've got a long history of like doing amazing stuff.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, and generally,
that's only my second career.
Yeah. So you kind of I think when we first spoke, you were just at the beginning of like moving into AI stuff, right?
Maybe. I don't even remember when that was. I know it was just before the Supabase interview that you did, because when you recorded the chat with Ant, I was in the other room.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know he was recording with you. I would have popped in and said hi.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were two of our biggest episodes. So.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, but thank you so much for coming back.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming to the studio. Yeah, this is where we record Laden Space. I am now, you know, a podcaster just like you, and it's having fun with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I guess like there were a few things I wanted to talk to you about. There's almost an endless list. But we're going to talk about angel investing in DevTools, because you've done a lot of that, and what you've learned and how you do it. We're going to talk about how you see the future of like Gen AI stuff affecting DevTools, whether there's things that people should be thinking about. And I think also just, well, I'd say those are the two main topics that we want to talk about and just other stuff. Okay, quick announcement. WorkOS are hosting a one-day conference dedicated to enterprise software. It's called the Enterprise Ready Conf, and it's taking place on October 30th in San Francisco. They have got the founder and CEO of Vanta, Christina, speaking, as well as the head of product for ChatGPT. Yes, ChatGPT, Brit. So if you've got questions for them, go along. And they've got the founder of WorkOS, of course, Michael Greenwich, who's been on the show twice. And you know how much he knows about enterprise software. So if you're kind of thinking about, you know, selling enterprise software, or you already do it, you should definitely check out this conference. Go to enterprise-ready.com or click the link in the show notes.
You know, one thing I do reference about for DevRel is like, I think like any competent DevRel eventually stops doing DevRel for one company and then starts doing it for many companies, because it's a rare enough skill set that if you do well, you can sort of franchise it. And that's how I view the AI engineer conferences. So, but this is, you know, instead of speaking at one at a time for one company, you could just run the conference and have like 100 companies come. So in that sense, I'm kind of applying my DevRel thoughts to how should an industry's DevRel motion look like. And that's where we are at with that.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. That's that makes sense.
Like speaking at doing in one talk, like it's no longer exciting, but coordinating 100 talks is scary.
yeah. And yeah, you did a very good job of that. It was great.
Oh, thanks.
Actually, maybe that's a fun aside of like, how was it to organize such a huge conference?
So this, for people who weren't there, let's give a concept of the size. So the first one was 500 people, and then the second one was 2,000. The conference is modeled after the large form factor conference, the World's Fair version. And a summit will always stay small, but World's Fair will grow. The large form factor version is modeled after basically stuff I saw throughout my DevRel career, DevTools career even, which is KubeCon, Big Data London, and AWS Summit, I think are the three that I like. There are some others I haven't personally been to, but I'm a big fan of on YouTube, which are GDC, like Game Dev Con, and Strange Loop, which recently ended. And I just think like every industry needs a definitive conference for their practitioners to gather and talk. Like it's really that simple. Like it's not, there's no big brain thing beyond once a year, let's get together and talk stuff. And people change jobs there, people find new co-workers or collaborators, or they launch startups there. All sorts of things can happen when you get people together. And I think that's the goal of that conference. So those other conferences that I mentioned are between 5 to let's say 30,000 people, and we're at 2,000 now. So we're trying to grow to that scale, such that AI engineering, the community that I help to name and serve, also gets to that level of legitimacy as a community. So I think like that's a good cause. You know, I like causes where it's bigger than me, and this thing's definitely already bigger than me. And all I do is I serve one specific role that, you know, pretty much only I could do, which is get people together.
Yeah, which is, yeah, as you said, is hugely valuable. And was there a moment where you thought consciously, like, this is what I'm going to do? Or is it like something that naturally?
Yeah, it doesn't happen by accident. I had to, so the launch sequence for AI Engineering Summit was the same as the launch sequence for AI Engineer itself, which is I run about in February of last year, I had a hackathon, which I had the fundamental realization that software engineers building with AI were a much different category, require a different skill set. The kind of people who are successful with generative AI were different than the ML engineers. And also that software engineers would win over the prompt engineers. Now it seems obvious, rewind this, you know, February 2023, it wasn't as obvious because everyone was only talking about prompt engineering and didn't really have a title for anything else. And so then I was like, okay, like we should develop this term. I went through a few candidates, including LLM engineer, cognitive engineer. There's a bunch of other people that things that people people suggested, but worse is better, which is a phrase that all DevTools people need to know. AI engineer is like the worst version of something that can possibly stick, and therefore it the world will descend towards it. So I just kind of went all the way and claimed it. I wrote the essay, but before writing the essay, I got the conference ready, so that when I wrote the essay, I also launched the conference, and then I rebranded the podcast to focus on that as well. So yeah, all those things that happened between April and June last year, and then October was the conference. So, and from there on, it kind of started. But that launch was probably one of the most intentional things I've ever done in my life. It wasn't an accident.
Yeah, that is, I guess, not surprising, actually, knowing you. Just like,
oh, no, I'm usually very random. Really? I'm usually very random
and seem, sort of free-spirited, you seem very
chaotic. Really? No. Like, I have principles, not plans, right? Like, there's certain themes I like to keep coming back to. It's a certain way I like to operate. But I usually don't plan, like, 3 months out.
That's actually surprising. Yeah, that makes sense. Because you wrote that essay, I think, like, gets quoted a lot on like Twitter and stuff about like you have like you have loads of the like greater than this is greater than this, this is greater than.
Yes, yeah. Those are principles.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not fans.
Yeah.
In some sense, maybe I somewhat don't believe in plans because obviously things can change and. The future is uncertain, and you know the plan gets changed the first moment, first contact it has with reality. But obviously, I believe in planning. Like the act of planning itself is preparation that is necessary anyway. The plan itself can change, whatever.
Yes.
So I think actually I need to do more planning rather than less. And if there's anything I'm more interested in than AI engineering, it is this idea that we can be more intentional with our lives, and with the way that we win and succeed in business and in life. And I'm trying to form a philosophy around that. This is already getting too philosophical already,
this
so we can jump off there. But so if I ever started a thing that would be bigger than AI engineering, it would be something around the topic of winning or intentionality or high agency. To me, all those three things are basically the same thing, which is how do you win on purpose? How do you build a support group or accountability group and a system for yourself, even without others around you, that improves your chances of doing whatever it is you're trying to do with your life. I know this sounds a little bit like self-helpy, but it is that in that domain. For anyone who is interested in this topic, I think the line of thread that is very prevalent in San Francisco is this talk given by Dan Gross at YC called How to Win. And it starts off with get 8 hours of sleep, and it ends with some business stuff. But if you don't, for example, get 8 hours of sleep, if you don't manage your own personal health, you're not going to do the other stuff. So get 8 hours of sleep, get good nutrition, and then work from there.
Yeah. And where do you see people like falling down the most? Because is it like when you say this, like about the intentionality, the things that I'm thinking is like, I have maybe multiple things that I'm working on, and sometimes like some of them are not like all moving in the same direction. And is it that sort of like?
No. How did those multiple things that you're working on arrive at your plate? Should you be working on them? I don't even care if they're moving in different directions. It's fine if they are, but should you be working on them at all, or should you just drop it?
Because sometimes it's like, it was just a good opportunity, like maybe you needed some money or like, you know.
Right, sure. I definitely do think that this kind of thinking is for people who have some security in their life, where you don't have to be rich, but you can just be secure in a sense that if all the other stuff fails, I can go get a job somewhere and submit my agency to someone else's agency, and that's fine, and then I will survive and live and provide for my family, and that's all okay. I think this is for people who want to strike out on their own and who want to take some risks, and knowing that there's a safety net for them if they fail. And definitely in San Francisco here, like you definitely feel that the idea that it's actually more than okay to fail. Like having failed actually improves your employability, because now you can say you're a former founder, you know, and people like to count their employees by how many former founders they have under their wing, right? Because then it proves that they're better than all of them. Like Supabase says, like we have 30 former founders.
Yeah,
it's great. Great for you, Supabase. And so that's great. Like I think like once you achieve some level of financial security and career security, whatever that means to you, then you should think about how to win. And you know, there's one thing we all have limited time of is just time on Earth, and we should try to do more impactful things with that time. Whether or not it is. I even think like the phrase strike out on your own is too much. Not everybody should be a founder. Not everybody should be a content creator. You can do more as a group than you can on your own. And if you just find a group, team, leader that you're just like you like working with, and you do they get the most out of you, then do that. You know, those that's kind of irrelevant from like, is this what you're made to do, and are these the most important problems in the world that you're solving, that you can solve? So I really like that. So for example, I'll give you a concrete example, and then we can kind of move back to DevTools. I always like the format of Alcoholics Anonymous. How familiar are people in the UK with that?
Yeah, seems very like an familiar. American... For it. And I think it comes up in like a lot of books as well about like the habit, like that. I think that habit. There's a book about habits.
Atomic Habits or something else? Could be. There's many.
It was not that one. It was the other one.
Okay. Yeah, I think Alcoholics Anonymous is just a good adherence and accountability system that doesn't have anything to do with alcohol. Mm. So what if we had AA but for accountability or for achieving your goals, right? So they have all these steps. They're non-judgmental. They go around. They share their issues and. There's a support group element to that, and there's a little bit of an anonymity, or at least Chatham House rules, whatever they call that, which is like you don't share what you learn in those meetings. All of which I think we need and we don't have in life. It's just weird that it just doesn't exist, and I would like to start that or take part in it. Again, this is one of those things where like it's a mission. What I define as a mission is something where you're happy if someone else does it better than you.
Mm.
So I actually don't even want to start this. I just want to join it. It just doesn't exist. Therefore, I have to start it. So that is the mission. The winning group is that. But the one problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is, well, one, it's alcohol, so it's a very serious topic. This is a bit less serious than life and death and mental addiction and illness and all that. This is just work. This is lower tier than that, if in the hierarchy of personal issues that are important and life changing. I think there's too many steps. I think really you want to reduce things to two steps. So everyone, in my ideal vision of the world, everyone comes in, they're prepared to answer two questions, right, and only talk about two questions and hear it from the other, everyone else attending. The two questions are, one, what are the most important things in the world that you should be working on? And two, why haven't you done it yet?
Yeah, that's really powerful. I was just almost like answering it for myself, and it's
I think, and then just go around because you hearing other people's stuff also helps you with your stuff. And anytime you're not winning, it's one of those two things: you're not working on good things, or you're blocked in some way. It's a mental block, it's a financial block, it's a physical personal relationship block, whatever. It's like blockers and whatever direction or goal setting. Actually, people a lot of things. So a lot of these, like, you can count a lot of this self-help stuff in the productivity domain, where people said you want to have this productivity system, bullet journaling, whatever. Not enough time is spent on strategy.
Yeah.
Are you working on the right things?
Yeah.
And actually, most people are probably not working on the right things.
Yeah.
So myself included, I one of the reasons I have not started this yet is I don't feel in a very secure position to teach this because I don't have it figured out. I think I almost feel like I want to have made it first and then I can turn back and give back. Whereas this is kind of like building a support system for myself because I need it.
Yeah.
Therefore, I don't have any answers. And it's just very hard to lead people if you don't have any answers. If you don't have any credibility. But in a sense, like, I am thinking about this. I am working on this with myself, with ChatGPT. Sometimes we are, in my company, working on this idea of a small CEO. I have the domain small.ceo. And literally, I want to just hand it over and have it just be my boss and ask those two questions to me every day and make sure that I'm aligned on it.
That sounds great.
It doesn't. I pitched this at a dinner with some ML researchers. They were shocked and horrified.
Really?
They were like, "Well, it's the inverse of what you're supposed to do with AI. AI, like, you the human are supposed to be at the top level, and the AI is supposed to be at the bottom level, executing the will of the human." And so I'm really talking about the inversion of that. The humans are very bad at executive function and following through and doing things you said you were going to do. And what if you just handed that over to the AI and then you became the mindless executing things machine? So that's a little bit of a controversial thought. I made it more palatable for them by saying it's kind of like a layer sandwich of human, machine, human. So human at the top, it's board of directors. Machine is CEO. And then human at the bottom for doing the thing that you signed up to do.
Yeah. And I guess, like, it's also like you're not necessarily giving, like, it's helping you to make decisions based on what you think, and it's asking good questions.
Yeah, the standard question that any manager could ask. If you had any manager, it would go through the same manager playbook that any manager would have, and you don't really even need them there.
Yeah, and I guess the accountability is the huge factor, is that, like, as a CEO, like, you're kind of, you could argue you're not really accountable to anyone else, in a sense.
Accountable to your customers.
Accountable to your customers.
Your investors, your employees.
Yeah.
The other thing I also think, like, I think some people, different people work in different ways. I find that I'm a very stateless person. Like, I like to receive information, react to it, do something else, and then I move on to the next thing. But as a founder, as a CEO, as a manager of people, you're paid to maintain state.
Yeah.
In the same way that a lot of dev tools are paid to maintain a database.
Yeah.
Any, like, logging, observability, database, or any chat, or it's just various forms of database.
And a state in this case is like the vision.
Is this thing done? What task is owned by whom? And are they overdue? Where the hell's the status update? That's just like typical manager CEO nonsense.
Yeah.
Probably could be done better by someone else than me, because I don't like to hold that state. I like to be stateless. In particular, you know about the, do you know the Eisenhower Matrix? I think a lot of people. I'm surprised that it's not more
Oh.
common. Most people have seen it, they don't know the name
Is
of it.
it
It's the two by
important,
two chart.
urgent?
It's a two by two chart where there's tasks that are important and not important, and
Yeah.
there's urgent and non-urgent,
Yeah.
right?
Okay,
And
so yeah.
so obviously everyone says you have to do throw away the non-important things, only do important things, and then prioritize the urgent things and not the non-urgent things.
Yeah.
There's a non-linearity with the Eisenhower Matrix where many important things in life are non-urgent, but they're important. And sometimes they become urgent. So a common scenario for this for me is taxes, filing taxes. I know every year, like I have all the information by December 31st when I need to file for April 15th, which is filing day in the US. Why don't I take any time within that 3 months to file? Because it's not urgent. On April 14th, it's very urgent.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'm like scrambling for accountants and stuff. There's many non-linearities in life like that where there's zero difference between whether you do it today or tomorrow. But if you don't do it before a deadline, then suddenly it becomes very
Yeah.
expensive. Whether it's like flights or hiring someone or whatever. The costliest things are the invisible deadlines where you don't even know there's a set deadline, but there was one and you didn't know it and it passed.
What kind of things would that would be like?
Sometimes it's training a model that you know there's like this brief window where it was possible to train open source like GPT-3 class models, which is what GPT-J was doing and Llama was doing, and then now there's not an increasingly closed source, and there was a brief window where it was kind of easy to get into the AI teams, like even like NLP or LLM teams. They were not prestigious,
Yeah.
you know. It was a very small window. I've interviewed some of these folks where they're like, yeah, I accidentally became a leading researcher in this area because no one else wanted it, and I thought it was interesting. I just picked it because it was open,
Yeah.
and like now I'm like one of like 10 people in the world that has trained a large language model to this scale, and you'll continue to be so.
Yeah.
Those initial luck or active
Compounds.
decisions compound.
Yeah.
So that was an invisible deadline that nobody understood except for people who were paying attention and some people who are lucky. And I think there are many like that where like so for me sometimes it was, let's say the visa stuff, right? There's a hard deadline with my conference trying to get to my own conference and get the visa in that time. But many invisible deadlines in the 6 months prior where I didn't know that I should have done something,
Yeah.
and then that passed, and like that made it more expensive or caused further delays for me
Yeah.
to get my visa up to the point where it was the week before the conference. And my last fallback to the fallback failed because I also missed another deadline to get my visa waiver. Many many other cases. I think like a lot of the smartest planners in the world understand to clear the fog of war. Because it's one thing to know a deadline and then miss it because you were busy. It's another thing to not even know there was a deadline there and also miss that.
Yeah, the principles, it's like thinking intentionally about what you're doing and like
Yeah, intentionality, having agency, and maybe a more jargony term for it is executive function, but really just high agency. Doing what you actually internally want to do and want to exist for good reasons. And
and
surprisingly, people don't do that. They
yeah.
respond. They much rather copy.
Yeah.
They much rather react. They much rather look at existing leaderboard, an existing company ladder, for
Yeah.
example, and try to climb that.
Optimize within that.
And those are plenty good as well, but
Yeah.
they're not exactly high agency in the sense that you create a game that you think is worth winning and actually pursue it. Because I think those are the situations in which you have the most interesting mission that people can kind of join you and support for you. Like, I think if you pick a leaderboard or if you pick a company rung, company ladder, it becomes a zero-sum game
Yeah, you're
where
competing against.
you're competing. And competing is good, it's fine. I think that's a big part of winning. But I think it is leads to situations where it's zero-sum, your competitors don't share their information with you, all that stuff. But once you pick a worthy enough cause, the whole thing changes. Like, your competitors are like, oh yeah, we ran into that too, here's how we fixed it. Because at the end of the day, the cause is more important than any individual winning. And that's really helpful and important in life.
Yeah. So, and I guess that, like, if bringing that to like AI dev tools companies sense, or like if we call them dev tools, but like OpenAI at the beginning, no one else was thinking of doing this. Like, and they were like playing their own game. They weren't really competing against anyone else. It was like, can they actually do this? They believe this is important. Focus on that.
Yeah.
It's like maybe now. I think
Ilya Sutskever works like that. You listen to any interview that he's ever done. He's just been a through and through believer in AGI. And maybe the rest of the company believed it less than him. So in some sense, I feel like OpenAI potentially got lucky with a few hires that they made that skewed them in that way, because otherwise they would have just been another research lab that didn't go anywhere.
Interesting. And do you think now it's become this, like, it's much closer to like this like ladder situation? Not ladder, but like
There's a lot of internal policies in OpenAI. I know a few friends who've been effectively managed out or fired due to internal politics issues, and that arises in any, you know, 1,000+ person company. I think the question before OpenAI now is like, how well are they actually committed to the AGI goal instead of being like a product company, like a new Google, effectively. I think the people who are very pro, like obviously any outcome like that is amazing and worth pursuing and whatever, right? But I think the AI purists are disappointed in OpenAI for basically selling out to monetize their APIs, to monetize ChatGPT, to effectively stop thought leading on what frontier AGI should look like. It's debatable. Like we're recording this in early September. They're likely to announce GPT-5 early October. And we'll see what GPT-5 looks like. We'll see. I this is one of those things I try to debate less about what the shape of AGI is, because it's very hard to quantify, and like there are definitely people that are way smarter and more dedicated to it than I am. I just think that though, like it's worth understanding that the people who are most worried about safety are also the people who take AI more seriously than anyone else. Like the very reason they got here in the first place is they took AI more safely than everyone else. And because the AI purists tend to disregard safety, I don't think they take AI as seriously as they think. Because if you did take AI seriously, you should actually care a lot about safety, and you should care about missing. Like you should care about erring on the side of being too cautious, because the other side is catastrophic.
And so I guess like Ilya is like the archetype of that.
Potentially very, very, like he blew up his own company. Yeah. He blew up OpenAI to try to make it safe, and that failed. So now he's doing his own thing. But you know, OpenAI is definitely on its own path now. It's completely rid of all the safety. Like there's no longer any safety division. There is a safety systems person, Lillian Wang. She's amazing, but there's no longer a super alignment team. Those guys are gone because they went to Anthropic or they started their own company.
Yeah, that's very interesting. To bring it to DevTools.
Yes, I can tie the mission thing to the DevTools.
Yeah, no. But it was like, actually, like, I feel like it's kind of related that someone, so yesterday I was talking to, said, why are you interested in DevTools? Because devs are going to be obsolete. What's the point of building tools for devs? Like,
what was your answer?
My answer was like that I don't know if devs are going to be obsolete, honestly. Like, I don't know. Like, it's every step has been surprising how useful tools like Cursor now are. But people still need infrastructure. And so this hard, like, and that could become way bigger because it's going to lead to technology doing a lot more things. And so maybe things that help developers, you know, maybe it's helping less developers, but they could be doing a lot more and in control of a lot more infrastructure.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I should highlight one thing that's a common conflation that I used to have, maybe still do, which is you conflated dev tools and infrastructure. there's a world in which they're the same thing. There's a world in which they're different things. Mm. But it's interesting to think about why they're different and where they're different. There's a definitional issue there. But let's go back to the core of the argument. So my standard answer to this topic of will AI replace engineers, right, it's reductively, is that AI engineers will be the last job, not the first job to be replaced. Because AI engineers are the job that replaces the other guys' jobs, right? Like, you need AI engineers even more than you need ML researchers to do the last mile of automation for AI lawyer, AI teacher, whatever. So if you believe that AI will take away jobs, which I don't, because humans are very good at creating new jobs, then you still want to be an AI engineer because it will be the last job that that does all those things. That's the pat answer. I think the second level answer for the DevTool people is that there's a very strong interplay between systems engineering and AI, where AI is like very good at translating natural language to some format that it's trained to do, but it's not very good at systems design and not precise and not fast. All these things are issues that systems, like, we're just much better at for the last like 50, 60 years. So again, like, there's a world in which AI can model all that and do it eventually, but humans will comparatively have an advantage there because of the precision that is required, and the amount of thinking and planning that goes into making a database or making an internet or whatever, designing a chip. Although chip design is one that's being tried by being tackled by LLM. I have an investment in that area, but I think, like, it's definitely assisting humans rather than replacing them. This is something that there's a story that people like to hear a lot, that AI will not replace us, they will help us. It's a very touchy-feely good thing, like, it wins for everybody. Probably true for up to a point. Like, it's just, we're all just talking about timelines here, right? Like, when the classic example that people say, like, you know, automatic teller machines, ATMs, when they were introduced, did the number of bank tellers go up or down? Do you know?
You would assume down.
Went up for the next 20 years and then went down.
Okay. Why did it go up?
The number of banks continued to grow, you know.
So it was like a bigger trend outside.
Exactly. Eventually they go down and nobody regretted it. There was no systematic, like, crisis in society because there were no more bank tellers. They found other jobs. Like, we were very good at coming up with other jobs. Like, are you so cynical of human needs and human creativity that you can't imagine that there will be new jobs? I don't think so. And I'm completely fine with that. I don't have any issues. I think DevTools have a lot of value to them. AI DevTools have one thing going for them that all the other industries do not, which is they can have the user and the developer in the same loop because they're the same person. So they have this kind of natural self-acceleration loop that doesn't exist in the other industries of, like, AI lawyer, AI teacher, whatever. You always have to, like, ask someone else, is this what you want? Oh, it's not what you want, because it's some super obvious thing that you learned in, like, first year of doing the job. And then the engineers have to go back in their room and code for a bit.
So the feedback loop's much tighter because
obviously
developers are like, no, this sucks.
Yeah, let me change. Obviously. Yeah.
And so I guess there's, like, what you think, and there's also, you know, how you're acting and where you're putting your money and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a segue into, like, your angel investing and the things that you believe are going to be important.
Yeah. Interesting. Give me more prompting questions around that.
So I know there's some companies that we've had on the show that you've invested in. So you've invested in Superbase. Could you talk a bit about, like, why you think that Superbase is still going to be, like, a really important thing if we don't have it, regardless of what happens, I guess.
Okay. That AI lens is unnecessary. Like, okay. Superbase is just a very good Postgres company. It's enough, you know. When I invested, they were three, four guys coming out as YC. And by the way, Thor put me onto the investment. Like,
oh, really?
I wish I was that smart, but no, I just piggybacked on Thor. So Thor, like, you have Thor to thank.
Yeah, Thor already working now?
I think he was about to join.
Okay.
And he was like so convicted. Like, he does this. He tells his friends to invest. And,
yeah.
And then we're like, okay, like, you're smart. Like, you know what you're doing. But I really actually hesitated a long time for Superbase because they were at the time a very, very thin wrapper around Postgres. And you're just like, okay, like, why don't I just run Postgres on its own? And I think that I underestimated the sheer desire for better Postgres.
Hmm.
And that's effectively what they've done.
Yeah.
Then the even like the Firebase for Postgres angle came along afterwards.
So you invested before, didn't
have any of that.
Alternative.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. If they had said that to me, I would be like, ah, okay. but I don't think it existed back then. I think that's a lie. I think that someone had, I think if you ask Paul, he would have said that someone posted Superbase with that title while they were in YC before they were ready to launch, and it went kind of viral on Hacker News. And it was like the first inclination that they should go after the Firebase angle. But I wasn't paying attention to that initially.
And it wasn't like the hero.
It wasn't the hero section. Not yet. Yeah. I think it was hero shortly after, because they've been writing that for a while. And I think it's good. Like, this thing that sucks that is going to be killed by Google someday. We're doing it better. It's open source. Like, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
You know? So this is one of those things where, like, a really, like, it doesn't have to be any AI in it. Just have a really good system that people can spin up, that, you know, AI coding tools and dev tools can use if they want to. Like, and there's so many, I'm pretty sure GPT-4 knows the Superbase SDK inherently and just can just code it. So it becomes a much better interface to Postgres than AIs could write themselves.
Mm.
And that's great for both Superbase and for AI, that they can have this great persistence layer that's kind of intuitive and open source and manageable, like, in any environment that they want. It just works that I think a lot, you find this pattern a lot, that, like, what works well for humans happens to also be good in the AI centric world, because then they just provide a better layer for something on that humans and LLMs can use, except for some tools, which we'll talk about eventually, where that is starting to diverge as well. That human needs do differ from LLM needs, and there are some companies spinning up. Some of them are here, here being Solaris, which is the AI co-working space that we're recording in, where they actually specialize in that difference between LLMs and human needs.
Yeah, actually, it'd be great to know.
We've been talking about this on my podcast as the LLMOS, the class of tools that LLMs basically always need. So they need to search the web. So you know, you can plug them into the DuckDuckGo API or the Google SERP API or the whatever Bing has. Or you can plug them into some more dedicated LLM-focused search engines like Exa or Tavily. Or you can build your own. There's many people building their own. Or you can do browser automation like BrowserBase here is doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of these have very subtle, different at-scale requirements for plugging the results of a web search into an LLM. All of them, for example, they need some kind of, like, proxy rotation, they need some indexing, some different kind of caching or whatever. But for example, a very simple example is, that's one example. There's another tool in the toolbox for code interpreter. So OpenAI has its own code interpreter, but for everyone else, there's E2B, another early investment, which, by the way, I invested before they were an AI tool. And one simple example is that your error codes are no longer for humans. They're prompts that are fed back into the LLM so you can fix the code that generated the error code, right?
So
of course you would do it,
yeah.
Right? Like, right now, we take whatever error code we got and we chug it back in and hope the LLM figures it out. But what if the error code was a prompt that said specifically what you needed it to do? To be super clear, that is my dream of what E2B can become if they were that focused.
Yeah.
They're doing well not even doing that. They're doing well for a variety of other reasons. So, for example, what E2B is often could be viewed as like kind of an ephemeral coding environment, an ephemeral sandbox like you would a Fly.io or a Replit or something like that. But instead of human needs, so humans, we need a few of these, dozens of these, maybe. Mm. Whereas agents, they can kind of spin up hundreds of them simultaneously. They're just they're the same needs, but order of magnitude different. Mm. Where it's just had different requirements. Like it can be order of magnitude in terms of like parallelism, or order of magnitude difference in terms of like the latency requirements, because suddenly there's no human waiting time, it's machine waiting time is different. There's a bunch of like all these like really long tail things that if you just specialize in solving the problems for an LLM customer instead of a human customer, you start getting different product specs.
Yeah, that is actually like something I hadn't really thought about. That's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it's very convenient for DevTools investors to think about it this way, because it basically means that every thesis you ever had is going to be the next few orders of magnitude in product requirements, like must be 10 times faster, must be 100 times faster, must be 10 times more parallel, whatever. They're just augmented by AIs. Like they will be run in much larger scale than humans can, because obviously there's only one of me and like I can run 10 AIs at once and not really care.
That makes sense. That's really cool, actually. Yeah, it's got me thinking about like everything you're working on, like what does it look like if an LLM is using this rather than...
I even think like API keys need to fundamentally encode this concept. So like when you issue an API key, you typically expect the developer to use it.
Yeah.
But what if you had a different key for an LLM? Like what different permission levels do they need? What human in the loop review do they need for anything that's non-reversible? Stuff like that.
Yeah, because maybe you would flag things differently if you saw usage that's like...
Yeah.
In a friend of mine,
Fuad Martin, he worked on indent.com for 5 years, which was basically just human in the loop approval process. And he was like, I think this is something that people want for security and compliance reasons. Yeah. And suddenly AIs come along and they're like, oh, like we want humans to review AI, you know, tasks. Yeah. Like, you know, suddenly it became a very, very important thing. But he had worked the previous 5 years on this problem without going super viral or anything. Like, it was a decent, like, profitable company. It just wasn't like huge. Yeah. It was like 3-people company. And then 2 months ago, OpenAI acquired them.
Wow.
For this. Yeah, very, very, like if you just happen to work on dev tools and you work on things that like scale well for AIs and humans, like this not the, they're the same thing. They're not different problems. They're just different scales.
Mm. And so maybe like some tweaks, but just like attention.
I don't know how much he's tweaking. He can't say anything to me now that he's working for them.
Okay, cool. What other investments are you excited about?
You're asking me to pick favorites.
Okay, wait. Maybe I can
name children. I can name stuff that has...
Fireworks seems very exciting.
Yeah, I can name stuff that has been like popular in recent media. So Fireworks. I'm not an angel actually. Fireworks. I'm an advisor. I do a little bit of DevRel advising, and Fireworks pursued me for like half a year, and then I was like, fine. And they're basically the former PyTorch team from Facebook. And service, I think the original vision was basically spin out and just offer PyTorch as a service. And now it's more closer to an inference engine similar to Together AI. They serve the full stack of like fine tuning to providing GPUs to providing like serverless versions of what they do to like full on-prem stuff, and like there's more stuff I can't say. But you know, out of the many GPU as a service providers out there, it's basically Together and Fireworks. In my mind, they're the two leaders, and this is the one that Sequoia picked. So, like, I think they're doing fine there. They do need more like work in terms of their DevRel, which is where I come in.
Yeah.
They are hiring DevRel if anyone wants to join a top tier, definitely one of the top executing AI infrastructure companies I've come across. Surprisingly, no head of DevRel yet, because I refused to join a company. So I'm kind of like interim head of DevRel while we figure out who actually runs DevRel there.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good opportunity.
Yeah.
Just because, so then I wanted to ask you a bit about like actually getting into angel investing
Yeah,
and
okay.
if someone wants to like invest in DevTools.
Yeah, so
You wrote a great post, I should say, that people should definitely read the article that you wrote about us.
yeah, because I don't remember it anymore. You don't get into angel investing with the expectation that it'll make you money. Because you probably won't. And even if you do, you won't see it for 10 years, right? If you're successful, the company won't exit for a while because it'll just keep going up and up and up, which is what's happening with Superbase. And that's fine. That's great. You'd be happy, happy and cheerful for them. I think the first thing obviously is you have to have some money. I thought I was richer than I was because of Netlify. And because when so I counted my Netlify net worth and I counted my temporal net worth, I was like, oh, I have some like spare cash that I'm not doing anything with. Like, why not start investing? And then Zerp ended, and I realized that the paper money doesn't mean anything. And so now I'm like less rich than I thought I was. Anyway, but you start investing with some of your own cash, and eventually, which you do what I'm doing now, which is that you invest other people's money. So, as many investments as I seem to have here, it's not my money. It's actually money that other backers have given me to invest for them. And you can do it in two ways. You can either raise a rolling fund or a syndicate, or you can be a scout. And I chose the easier way, which is the scout. Because rolling fund syndicate, you have to do a lot of paper, lawyer work, tax work on your own. And scout stuff is basically all taken care of for you. And you don't realize anything until the company exits, which is great. So yeah, I have a good deal with CRV that does it, but every major VC firm has them. They all want to build good relationships with you. If you're a prominent DevTools, DevRel person, just hit them up. They'll probably say yes. And also then so then the real question is why do it, right? Those are the mechanics of how to start. You should also, by the way, you should also have like some amount of good industry networking, right? So if you are a good podcaster, tweeter, LinkedIner, whatever, like you'll get that. Others, you can kind of have more or less have to come from their own professional work history. So why do it? I think one, like there's a very obvious one, which is that it is basically my CV for if I ever become a VC someday. I'll just go look, and then they'll be like, oh, good deals. Like, that's the job, really. I don't have to apply. I don't have to fill out any application form. I just show them this, and they're like, yep, that's what we would want in someone that we work with. Like, what else do you need? And then two, you also get to work closely with the founders for anything that they need. So typically, my contract with founders is that if you need some DevRel advice, particularly before launch, if you're hiring DevRel, I can help there. And through that, I can observe how they do what they do, and a lot of these are like gonna encounter problems in ways that I would never have thought of before. And I think that's preparation for me becoming a founder myself and going through those exact same journey. So it's really good to basically be friends with these people who are like a few years ahead of you if you intend to go that route. I'm still not sure I'm going to exactly go that route, but I definitely have some of these that I would now count as advising me more than I advise them. And it's just a kind of like a two-way street there eventually.
That's actually amazing. So one of the things that I read recently from you was the your post on DevRel
Is
and
DevRel
kind of,
dead?
yeah, is DevRel
Oh, God.
dead? I know we didn't talk about discussing this, but
Yeah.
yeah.
I think I did one interview, one podcast with Changelog on that. So people want like an hour's worth of Is DevRel Dead? They can go there. But we can do a short one here. What interests you?
So I've heard a lot of founders kind of like saying, they don't need DevRel. You hear people say things along the lines of, oh, this person wanted, 250K to write to-do list apps or something. And like this kind of like,
That's exactly
that's,
what some DevRels have.
yeah.
That's their salary, and that's what they do.
So I guess, but then I also see like examples where there's DevRels who are very, very valuable. You think of like Superbase, they have like loads of Grey DevRels, for instance. And it's to me, it's clear that the skill set of people who understand the technology, understand like the real challenges that developers have, and then are very happy to create, you know, whether it's content or like experiences or like fill in the gaps that customers have, that aren't going to be met by like, that often just go unmet, I guess. That seems important.
Yeah.
Whatever you call that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you?
What's the question?
The question is like,
is DevRel dead?
Is DevRel dead?
So it has died off. I think I tried to quantify it in that post. It's like down 30%. So 30% is not 100, but it's not 10.
Mm.
So it's, yeah, 30% dead.
It's injured.
The fact is that many, many companies never needed DevRel. But there are many roles which you don't need if you can do within the team. You don't need HR, you know, like, is HR dead? No, you know, it's just not required at some companies because founder does everything, or like you achieve hiring through some other means. And like, I would say the same thing for DevRel and many other functions in a company. It's a choice whether or not you want a dedicated role to that, or you want to spread out that responsibility to the rest of the team. But it's a job to be done, I think, which is what you're kind of arrive at. Like marketing, you know, you can't build products and expect people to know about it or care about it unless you tell people about it. And probably there's a chart of the Lux surface area chart. Just Google the Lux surface area chart. You see this. You need to do things and tell people about it. Do things, tell people, do things. And so most normal DevTools companies over-index on doing too many things, and they're terrible at telling people about it. So effectively, what hiring DevRel is you hire people whose job is to yap all day long to sort of artificially extend that. Some of them are good at it, many are bad. And part of DevRel is also just kind of having the Emperor's New Clothes moment of like, actually, there are many people with like 5, 10, 15-year careers in DevRel who are horrible at their jobs. Horrible. And they should not be doing that job, and they should find something else to do. But people pay because they need the job title to be filled more than they need that person. And because those good people are very hard to reach. That's one thing there. I also mentioned some other thing that counts in the sort of DevRel is dead category, which is that bottoms up and open source has been very challenged in the growing a company success criteria, in the sense that that's what DevRel is focused on, bottoms up and open, and particularly open source. You don't have to be open source, but bottoms up, definitely.
Yeah.
As opposed to top down, where you kind of reach into select big name companies and sell directly to the CTO or whatever. I would say that the attribution issue for DevRel, same attribution as any marketing, is you don't know who watches the YouTube videos, and you definitely can't tie that to dollars.
Yeah.
So when you hit a recession or the company misses its goals, like DevRel becomes the first thing that gets laid off because they can't prove their existence, the validity of their existence. And I do think that that is a reckoning that needed to be done and is happening, that like you actually don't need that much bottoms up. You actually don't need to be loud on Twitter. You actually can just ship products to a small set of big name customers and then have everyone else show up later. I can't name, like, so Temporal was like this. Like our second customer was Snapchat. You know, like we didn't do a whole bunch of like be loud on Twitter and launch week 5, launch week 6. We didn't do any of that. Just build what your big customers want. Yeah. And then the big customer likes it. The slightly smaller customers look up and they go like, oh yeah, it's good enough for them. It's good enough for us. We'll pay you, you know, X amount of dollars. And every one of those customers is worth 10,000, 20,000 of the smaller ones. So why bother? So there's a lot of that reckoning going on with is DevRel dead? And I think what I really tried to phrase it as, like, the ZERP DevRel is dead. Like the zero interest rate, like travel around the world giving talks and really just seeing the same people at every talk. That is basically dead.
Yeah. But at the same time, I guess traveling to traveling
to San Francisco.
Traveling
for AI conferences, not dead.
Yeah, exactly. Sign up. Links in the bio. Links in the description.
Links in biology.
Yeah. But like, you know, it almost becomes like almost like a sales like targeted. It's like very. Here are targets. Like you're an extension of the marketing team.
DevRel has basically always been an extension of the marketing team. It's very much a lot of denial by DevRel people who think they are better than marketing to say that they are otherwise. You know, typically you have bullshit like DevRel is part of the product team. We give feedback from users to products. And all you have to ask them to burst their bubble is how many of the recent features that were shipped were from your direct feedback. And usually it's a small amount.
Okay.
There are very well-functioning companies that actually do respond to user feedback. But either they're not that busy, you know, your engineers don't have that heavy of a roadmap. Because guess what? Like at any hyper growth company that is serving large customers and small customers, guess who wins? The large customers.
As in they will focus on the features. If
they will often do. Because the other ones come with like 100x more money than the other ones. Yeah. So it is a huge problem and challenge of founders and PMs to balance those things. Yeah. And it should not be a surprise to anyone that the larger checks, larger customers usually win.
Yeah.
That's like through no fault of anyone. It's normal capitalism. That's just how it works.
Yeah.
And so then as a PM, as a DevRel, my requests get backlogged, shelved to the next quarter. Next quarter, I come around and I say the same thing again. My users are, I'm out there in front of my users every day. Talk to them. They say they want this.
Hmm.
We fall short to other competitors. When can we have this? Backlog again. And it takes like 3 quarters of that to just give up.
Yeah.
Which is a normal frustration. Like, I think like, I don't want people to hear this and go like, DevRel is a joke. Like, don't bother. I think you should fight for your customers. I think you should just be realistic that it is not 50% of your job, it is 1% of your job.
And most of your job is
getting
driving
customers. Yeah, customers. Getting your company in front of people who've never heard about it before that could potentially be users of it.
And I suppose you have to somewhat consciously or subconsciously, you have to be more effective at that than sales teams.
Yeah, it's typically the people who are not good at the main marketing job that then they're like, oh yeah, DevRel was never really about that. It was about the other stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're retreating to things that they can actually do better at because they suck at the other stuff.
Okay. And sorry, in that case, the other stuff would be like?
Direct sales. Let's say customer success. Like you're already a customer. Yeah. Now I'll make you more successful as a customer by teaching you how to use the tool you just bought. That happens a lot. Workshops, seminars, webinars, stuff like that. Basically, things further down the funnel. So you know tofu, mofu, bofu? Top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of funnel. DevRel should live at top of funnel, but eventually, you know, everyone's going to retreat a little bit to middle and bottom of funnel because that's where more money is. Yeah. It's more attributable. It's also safer. You don't have to, like lower chance of failing because if you're already talking to people who paid an annual contract to use your tool, then they're kind of captive. So you know that you're going to have some reception there. It's just like less risky. It's good and bad.
Yeah. And for founders, just to be like in kind of like a, what should I hire, you know, DevRel? I know this is like going to be like, it depends, but.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So we have like a couple posts on DX Tips. So by the way, DX Tips is my outlet.
Yeah, that's great.
Because
everyone should subscribe.
So it's DX.tips for people who want to see it. It's basically because I no longer identify as DevRel anymore. I care less about it, but I also like to vent on it every now and then. And people do ask my questions, my thoughts, and I think I find it better when you just write them down as one resource that you can keep sending around, as opposed to just responding every single time, custom. Because see, I have more concrete thoughts. Like I have a thought, I have a post on how to do hackathons well.
Yeah.
I have a post on how to do conferences as well. And so this, what's the post that we're talking about again? How to hire DevRel. Yeah, I have two on those because it's such a big deal. But TLDR, try to do the job yourself as a founder, because if you don't, it's just like anything. If you don't do the job yourself, you don't really know what you're looking for. You don't really know what works. And when you know what works, you can have a repeatable playbook to hand off to someone else. The bigger question comes like when you have decided to hire, regardless of whatever prep work you've done before or after, when you have to decide to hire, what kind of person do you hire? I would like to advocate for people to hire engineers who have paid for your tool at one of your Lighthouse customers. That is the sweet spot in my mind. So what am I not saying? I'm saying do not hire content creator divas who are big on YouTube and expect an NPM install audience on your company. That usually fails. And then do not hire engineering leaders, and then do not hire other DevRel who primarily are free tier DevRel. All these are failure traps. All these are traps of hiring for DevRel. There's one. I mean, one element of DevRel which I really like is that they are at least half engineer. All DevRel should be able to code. Actually, that's too strong a statement. There are DevRel that don't code and they do well, but they're very rare. They're in the minority of them, and they usually work at the bigger companies like Google, Amazon. For the smaller startups, you should probably want DevRels to code. And one out, if you make a mishire, is that you can just convert them to engineer. And a lot of them love it when they go from DevRel to engineer and maybe engineer back to DevRel. So give them that option. Make them go through the engineering loop and then also do the content creation stuff. Because you have a stronger dev person, employee in general, and maybe they do a little bit of DevRel, like sometimes, maybe not. Just give them an out as an engineer. I think that makes sense. And then the paid versus free tier DevRel is something that I hear a lot of confusion about. But to me, it's so obvious. Like so many DevRels are just, they get up on stage, they're like, use our stuff, it's free. They never ever, and obviously that gets applause because you're giving away software that's valuable for free. Who doesn't like that? That's not challenging at all. What's harder is like convincing me to pay for something. And people who've done that in their companies have done the bake-off with you versus all the other tools at risk. They put their jobs on the line to a boss and, you know, risk rejection, denial, failure, whatever. And they still believe in your tool, hire them. Because, you know, basically DevRels tend to replicate themselves. They'll use the words that appeal to them, then that will attract other people who for whom those words also appeal. And those happen to be your customers that you want.
So free tier, you don't want replicating of like free tier reasons to come check it out.
I don't want only free tier. Like obviously free tier is important and good. That's the reason people offer free tiers. And I do believe in freemium. But free tier only is bad. We did a lot of that in my previous job. So a lot of this also is kind of like therapy for myself, working through mistakes that I make that I would not wish on others and I would not want to repeat at my own company. So I definitely feel like people maybe mistake my authoritative tone as judgmental. It's not because I did that. And so I'm just trying to learn lessons and not repeat them.
I think that all of the things that I read that you put out come across that way, and that like it's your lessons and it's like your beliefs and stuff. And I think there was some people were like upset about like the DevRel is dead thing, but I don't think it was like, it was your views on like how things and your experiences and your personal like, and I feel like you're trying to actually like help people, and like, it was like, why deny the truth in the sense of like, there are challenges here. And I think you gave like really good, like perception or like a really good analysis of the situation. And then also that like, there are companies hiring DevRel, and here are the like the ways that it can be important, and people that adapt to that are going to actually succeed, rather than like denying that like there is this contraction in like DevRel at the moment.
I think people should not care basically about the contraction in DevRel. This is a industry-wide, sector-wide thing that almost certainly means nothing for your individual company. Your individual company situation, you should examine that from first principles. Look at the people that you have. If they're missing that, you might want to hire it. If not, and if you're the buck stops with you as a founder or a company leader or product leader, then you take that job. And those skills and those jobs to be done are timeless, and I'm happy supporting that. Whether or not you have the official job title, could care less. I do think that it could be easier for people. So I think in that post, I also mentioned the concept of the full stack DevRel. Most DevRel in like companies under 100, maybe even under 200, are full stack DevRel in the sense that they basically operate as independent autonomous units, kind of like you are right now. Yeah. You book your guests, you decide what your marketing is, you decide what your topics coverage is, and you publish, you edit, you do everything. In larger companies, like no media organization works like that, right? They have editors, they have back office people that do the processing, the journalists and the reporters, like they do the front end of like interviewing and deciding what's relevant and to stay in the flow. And the media organization takes their job seriously enough to invest in the back office so that the front office people can do their jobs well. And what effectively all DevRel is a media company operating inside a tech company. And the sooner that a tech company realizes that they are running a media operation, they should maybe learn lessons from real media organizations and maybe not operate at the same scale, but the functionality and grouping of jobs probably makes sense in some sense. What else should I say there? Yeah, so I have concepts about the front, middle, back office of DevRel. People can read that on DX Tips.
Yeah.
I also mentioned this in my book, by the way. Book plug, but that goes back
to further.
Coding Career Handbook talks a little bit about the front middle office for developers. But I think for DevRel, that is necessary and increasingly important as people want to systematize the way that they work with their community. I don't know, like I wish more tools, I could recommend more tools, you know, like there used to be like Orbit.
Yeah.
Or Common Room or stuff like that. They all, none of them are working out super particularly well. I think Orbit failed.
Yeah.
Orbit
was it acquired by Postman? Or was that another one?
Whatever. I don't know. Yeah. There are other sort of community services. There's a lot of like draft.dev used to be a thing. Iron something used to be a thing. Basically like would turn a podcast into a blog post or the other way, blog post to podcast or video to whatever. And I wish there were more tools like that that were more successful so I could point to them as examples of you can use this. But all of them are experiments at this point. And I think that the problem is like there are all these mechanics of doing the job, like produce one blog post a week and then like, you know, one webinar a month, whatever. And there's no taste, there's no love, there's no engagement in the community.
Yeah.
I think that's what people really need, that authentic engagement that you can't really systematize yet. I think that someone out there could, but right now it's always these like thought leaders that lead things. And that's great if you have a thought leader. If you don't, then you're shit out of luck. And I always wish that part of my like job with DX Tips is to kind of demystify that process so that more people could kind of engage in that conversation because they've just never been taught how to. It's not a thing that you learn in university or anything.
Yeah, this is really helpful.
Yeah. Thanks, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that apart from like happy to answer questions on DX Tips. I tried to time box that because I think I need to my like next level of success, you know, like it's again with going back all the way to the initial conversation about winning, is this the thing I'm supposed to do, like advising on DevRel? I don't think so. I don't think like people like super need it. Like there's many other qualified advisors out there. My advice isn't going to be like that much game changing compared to like other people, except in, maybe in AI engineering. Like obviously that's the place I carved out.
Practice. I think you're one of those like people that's like good at many things, and I think I would still consider you as like, I think that you have a very very rare ability of like communicating concepts and thinking and systems. Thanks. And I think that you probably are the, at least that I've come across in the kind of like DevRel space, the best person. Like you have like I think your purpose in the AI landscape is like is bigger probably. So
yeah, I think I think like what I love about it is I can repeat myself and not feel bored.
Yeah.
And so that's a sign that you've like you have something you believe in.
Yeah.
You know? And I've done that. I've done many, many podcasts just evangelizing the idea.
Yeah.
People get jobs on it and sometimes they don't even know that I was involved in it, and that's great.
Yeah.
GitHub recently launched a Hugging Face competitor, and right across their front page was AI engineers.
Yeah.
And
it's just crazy.
It's just this market that like is growing, and I think, you know, if we serve it well, I think it's its own industry that's going to emerge that I had a part to play in, and I think that's beautiful. The other thing now is to build services rather than thought lead. And that's something that I historically haven't done before, and I'm doing now. So I'm building AI News, which you know about, and seeing what it could become. I just had a chat with Andre Karpathy this morning about casual name drop there.
Wow.
But I would consider him a mentor of mine. I've considered trying to work with him more, but he's very independent minded and obviously doesn't need any money or anything like that. But there's a general desire for general purpose summarization and teaching. For him, he wants to make the best course in the world for AI.
Yeah.
For me, it's, there's a lot of, in generative AI, there's a lot of like, put in this prompt and then it becomes like 10 different things.
Yeah.
There's a lot of signal that becomes noise.
Yeah.
And I want to take noise and condense back to signal. And I think that too many people are doing the thing where like signal noise, and then not enough people are doing noise signal.
Yeah, and that's kind of what you do as well, right? Like as a person, like I feel like that's one of the things that you've been really good at.
Thanks, I try.
I think so, right? Even when we were talking about like taking this, like condensing things into like kind of principles or like.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I do like that. I wish I was, my problem is I am too much of a hoarder and completionist. And the people who are best at signal to noise, noise to signal, are minimalists. They want the, who's the other guy? Jack something, the visualized value, you know, Jack Butcher. You seen him?
Oh, yes.
You want to be the kind of guy with like two words in your bio, you know, and like he like just tweets an image where it's like that and it's like that and then it's like you get 10,000 likes. I'm not that kind of guy. I'm a word cell. I have too much words. I think that is too simplistic and I don't like that. And sometimes it's very inauthentic in how the minimalists take the most engaging, rage-inducing headline and just tweet that. That's it. So I like nuance, which is a flaw because nuance is also noise for some people. It is.
Yes, but I feel like people resonate to like are drawn to their own
style.
Amount of like abstraction.
I think you should have tunable noise. So what I would like, I don't know if we're gonna build this, but I would like basically an urban dictionary. Have you seen Urban Dictionary?
Yeah.
Dictionary where you can kind of tune your explanations of anything to you, to what the depth of nuance that you would want. I have it in the spec sheet somewhere. I want the two-word version of something. I want a one-sentence, two-sentence, one paragraph, three paragraphs, one essay, one book, something like that. And just constantly update that. And then you also want, apart from length, you also want to vary by, like, thinking hat.
Yeah.
So you want the funny version, right? Because there's always this little bit of truth in humor.
Yeah.
You want the cynical version, because there's always a bit of truth in, like, all right, if you strip away the hypey bullshit, like, what are you really doing?
Yeah.
And then you also want the hypey version. You want the like, what is the best possible version of this that could possibly be, even if you fall short.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line is truth.
Yeah.
But you're never gonna, if you only have one version of truth, you're never really gonna hit it because it's impossible to represent truth in one definitive statement. You'll probably need like six. That's something we're ideating on, me and my co-founder. I don't know if we'll ever see the light of day, but I kind of do want it to exist in the world where we have, you know, rotten tomatoes for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. The levels of kind of abstraction and detail reminded me of, there was the talk at the first AI Engineer Summit.
Amelia Wattenberger.
Watson.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the first time I saw that concept where you're like using LLMs to have like different levels of like detail.
So she was working at Adept. Adept failed shortly after, but she still continued to do interesting work with email. Like just today, I was obsessing over the latest product that she's working on. She's back at GitHub now. She used to work on GitHub Copilot. Now they're basically at the GitHub Innovation Lab doing stuff like
cool
that.
Cool stuff.
Cool yeah. stuff, whatever they want. And like, yeah, what I love about the conference is there's a forum for people like her to present their work, because yeah. her work would not be eligible at NeurIPS or ICML or any other of these like academic conferences, because it's not academia, it's product.
Yeah.
It's engineering. And that's what we're focused on.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think we're probably at your time.
Yeah, awesome.
But this was amazing. Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Cool. Hopefully there was something that
you
were
looking
for.
It was so great.
Okay.
yeah. From my perspective, I hope everyone listening enjoyed it as much as I did.
A little bit random. I was worried that we'd spent too long at the start philosophically, but whatever.
Well, people can tell us if we did. From my perspective, we didn't. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sean,
thank you for continuing to grind. Like, you are one of the more authentic voices out there for like dev tools, and like, you know, I think your personal intellectual curiosity like shines through, and I hope you never lose sight of that.
Thank you. And where would you point people to? We've talked about dx.tips.
Oh boy.
Small would we?
Yeah.
Go to?
So like probably the highest most relevant thing is Latent Space. So go to latent.space. That's the podcast that I run with Alessio in this studio every week. And that's the most polished version of what everything I have going on. And then twice a year, you can come to AI Engineer. That's AI.engineer. And then I'm working on a startup called small.ai. And right now we do a daily newsletter that is definitely not polished, but is endorsed by some of the top names in the field.
Andre Kopafe is.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Sean. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you.